right. I have a couple of notes to remind myself here. I want to start off with just a correction. There's a typo in the bulletin. It's Jesse Marr, not Murr. It's an A, not a U. And he's that young man sitting back there beside my daughters waving. I thought he might be blushing furiously, but he's not. He's proud to be identified, and we're glad that he is now a part of our family. Secondly, I want to make sure and thank the elders for the opportunity to speak this morning. That's putting a lot of trust in me, and I appreciate that. Thank you. If you're visiting with us, do want to make sure that you know you're welcome. I was looking around this morning, and there's a lot of faces I don't recognize. So either I've been blind for the last year or so, or we have some visitors, and we're grateful that you're here with us this morning. We ask you please stick around so we can get to know you a little bit. All right, you may have noticed I'm not the guy that's usually up here. Even though we have the same last name, Austin, we cannot find that we are related. So Doug and I, so don't blame him for any mistakes that I make. But I appreciate the opportunity. This morning's lesson is titled, Who Are You? And it's not just because I'm a new person up here speaking to you, but because unlike what Doug said last week, I'm going to politely disagree with him. I don't think that everyone at 25 has it all figured out. I don't think that even people at 50 have it all figured out. So I surveyed the now 25-year-old sitting right back there, my daughter Abigail. Happy birthday. She and I agree that most 25-year-olds do not have it all figured out. They don't know who they are. They don't know where they're going. And like I said, most 50-year-olds don't have it all figured out. I still sometimes say, only half-jokingly, that I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I should probably figure that out sooner rather than later at this point. Think about how much our society struggles with the concept of identity. So we have people in our society who claim that they're the wrong gender. We have people who claim that they're not even human, that they're animals, right? We have people who, I was just reading an article about a surgeon in Europe who kept reinfecting his lower legs because he did not feel that his body was the way he was supposed to be when he had intact legs. He ended up getting both of his legs amputated because that matched the image he had of who he was. And then there's the idea that people change jobs a lot. The average, I looked this up, is now 14 times that an adult will change jobs over the course of their career. That number used to only be 7. That was 20 years ago the last time I looked that up. So in 20 years, that number's doubled. Don't ask me how many jobs I've had. I've far exceeded that number. Number of houses, the same. But why is that? Why do people keep going from job to job? Why do they keep going from house to house? They're searching for identity. They think, well, maybe this next job, I'll get along with people, I'll know who I am, I'll be comfortable. Or maybe if I get the raise, go to that other job with a little bit more money, I can be who I'm supposed to be. Or maybe house number 20 will finally feel like home. Because we're searching for identity. Now I realize that's not true for everyone. Some people do know who they are. Go back to the Old Testament. There was a man who, as soon as he was questioned, he knew exactly who he was. In the book of Jonah, we read in Jonah chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, then they said to him, these are the other people on the boat, tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. What's your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country? And of what people are you? So they give him like 5 questions there, and he says to them, I'm a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. 5 different questions, he gives them one answer. I'm a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. Jonah had no doubt about who he was, but what's interesting is he didn't answer all of their questions about occupation and such. He identified himself in relation to God. And I think that's what's missing for a lot of people is we don't know who we are because we don't understand our identity in relation to God. But in the New Testament, in the book of 1 Peter, where we're going to be looking this morning, Peter gives us the answer. Really, it's God giving us the answer through Peter. who are we? In 1 Peter 2:9 we read, but you're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So God, through Peter, is going to give us four titles, four names, four different identifiers that God uses to describe us. First off, he says we're a chosen race. I want you to think about that word chosen. What does that mean? Well, there's not a lot of synonyms for chosen. Pick, choose, select. But no matter which word you use, that means that God picked us. That means that God picked you, and he chose me. And he gave that selection to everyone who responds to his call. Now, this isn't like when we were in elementary school and we were all hoping that we weren't picked last for teams for dodgeball. Not that I know anything about that. But God chose us first from the beginning. He selected us as the first round draft pick. We're not the leftovers in the back of the fridge after everyone else has eaten and God was rummaging around to find what was left. He picked us first. From the beginning, God chose us. And what makes this even more interesting, even more relevant, this is not just Peter writing a new concept in the first century, but he's going back to what God said, back to the Pentateuch. In Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 6, he says, for you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. God says, out of everybody, I chose you. In fact, Peter's so convinced of our chosenness, it's not really a word, but I'm going to use it today, that he says in verse 2 of this letter, that they is written to the chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father in the sanctification of the Spirit for obedience to Jesus Christ and for sprinkling with his blood. May grace and peace be multiplied to you. You're chosen. And that word chosen reminds me, there's a show that's been on for a few seasons now called The Chosen. But one thing that I don't like about that show is it makes it seem like it's just those select few, those first few disciples that are chosen. And that's not true, because God extends that title to everyone who responds to his call. He extends that title to you and me also. There's a verse that Doug used last week, and I want to repeat it this morning. John chapter 1, verse 12. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. God chose you to adopt you. Secondly, Peter calls us a royal priesthood. Remember that Peter's writing to Christians who came out of Judaism. And as Jews, they were familiar with what it took to be a priest. Not only did you have to be from the tribe of Levi, but you had to be a man, you had to be between certain ages, you had to be physically perfect, no physical defects, and even then, only a few who met all those qualifications could serve as a priest. And Peter tells us again earlier in the chapter 2, that priesthood has changed from those of the tribe of Levi to us, whose identity is now in Christ. 1 Peter 2:5, you yourselves like living stones are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And this is something that Isaiah prophesied, predicted hundreds of years earlier. In Isaiah 61 and verse 6, he says, but you shall be called the priests of the Lord. They shall speak of you as the ministers of our God. You shall eat the wealth of the nations, and in their glory you shall boast. Isaiah wasn't just speaking to the Levites. He was speaking to the people of Israel and the spiritual heirs, the church. You shall be called priests and ministers. Going back even further, we go back to Exodus chapter 19 and verse 6. God speaking to Moses, he says, "And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel." And I like this verse because it helps me transition to the next title that Peter gave us, which is a holy nation, right here in this verse. Now, when we think about holy, some synonyms or some ways we describe that is set apart, consecrated, sanctified. So if you are a holy nation, that holds true for us, right? Just like Aaron and his sons were set apart in Exodus chapter 40, they underwent consecration. We too have been chosen, set apart, and consecrated. Another way to look at this is to consider the idea of purification. Purification needed for holiness. Even the high priest, he was a man who had met all those requirements we talked about a moment ago, had to undergo additional cleansing and offer an additional sacrifice for his own purification before he could enter the presence of the Lord, before he could go into the Holy of Holies. This purification is an interesting concept. I'm going to tell a little story from my youth. When I was little, my dad used to collect lead, old car battery leads, the little weights off the tires or the rims, and he would make lead sinkers out of it. Now, you all are from down here, and you don't understand the concept of deep sea fishing, most likely, because there's not a lot of deep sea around Roswell, New Mexico. But to get the hook with the bait down to the floor of the ocean where the halibut live, you got to use some pretty significant weight, because you're not just fishing in like 40 or 50 feet of water. Sometimes you're fishing in 500, 700, 1,000 feet of water. And then when you get that tide coming in or out, you can run out of line on your rod or on your reel before you ever get that bait down to the bottom to catch a fish, so you have to make some sinkers. And Dad would make 1 pound and 2 pound sinkers, sometimes 3 pound or even 5 pound sinkers. But to do that, he would collect all this lead, and to turn it into a sinker, you have to heat it up. And when you heat up a metal, no matter how pure it is, there's always stuff that collects on the top. We call that the dross. But it's all the impurities, the junk. And even taking supposedly pure lead, you would still end up with these impurities on top. Why do you have to remove the impurities? Well, because if you don't, when you take that liquid lead and you pour it into the mold, it's going to cause a gap. That sinker will not form to the mold properly. And so it's useless. You have to melt it down and start over again. So you purify the metal by cleaning that stuff off the top. And I have a little reminder on the back of my hand about how painful that purification process can be. Had a little drop of lead, it had cooled, went to pick it up. It was no longer red, but it was still hot. Landed on the back of my hand and burnt me. So when I think of purification, I think that there's some pain associated with that. When we think about Paul, he was an apostle, he was this great preacher. We think of him pretty highly, don't we? But he was a man who went through purification. Consider what Paul writes in Colossians 1:13. He's rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of the Son he loves. Paul, when he was Saul, was a man who thought he was following God's will, and Paul says he rescued us from the domain of darkness. Or delivered us. Now, when we come back to Peter, touch base again, that thought of being a separate nation continues in verse 11, where he refers to us as, depending on your translation, strangers and exiles or aliens. And I like that word aliens, because if there's a concept the citizens of Roswell, New Mexico should understand, it's aliens, right? What do we know about aliens? They're not from around here. They're not of this world. They don't belong here. And as a holy nation, we don't belong to this world either. Why? Because we are citizens of a kingdom that Jesus said in John 18 is what? Not of this world. Romans Peter's final title for us is A People for God's Own Possession, or God's Own People. And we say that about our family sometimes, or our close friends, that these are my people, right? We get that. And if we are close enough with somebody, if we have that strong a relationship to call them our people, there are not a lot of lengths we wouldn't go to for them. And God went to pretty extreme lengths for us, right? Romans 5:8. But God shows his love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Remember, Jesus, perfect Son of God, seated at his right hand, left heaven, came to earth, lived a perfect life, and then sacrificed himself for us. Paul, I'm going to skip the next verse, Romans 9, 25 and 26, even though it's in the outline. I kept getting tongue-tied trying to read it, so we're going to skip that. We're going to go on to Leviticus 26 and verse 12. I will walk among you and will be your God, and you shall be my people. Now, I want to draw your attention to the fact that none of these titles, none of these names that God gives us through Peter are individual titles. It's not the Lone Ranger, even though he had Tonto. You're not the last of the Mohicans. We're not the solo voyagers or the individual explorers setting out. They're all group names, right? Part of a great body of believers who share the same title. While we're called individually, we serve collectively. And I appreciate David's comments this morning about the church. God's not calling us to be the single beacon of light in the darkness, although sometimes that's what we need to be. He gives us the church. He gives us a group, a collective, and every one of those names reminds us of that. Back when I was in the Air Force, this has been probably 15 years ago now, I was in my residency, and we had to travel to different hospitals and for our residency, and our commander had an expectation that we would wear our uniform or a nice shirt and tie, slacks, dress shoes, all of that, to these residency sites. And he came to check on us one day right after we were finishing up, and my classmate, Bill Wolf, and myself are in shorts, t-shirt, and sandals. And he got really upset with us. He's like, why are you dressed like this? Well, the reason was there was no place to put a uniform or nice clothes. We had to stuff our belongings into a backpack and carry them into the operating room with us. But he said something, and it stuck with me for so long. He said, remember who you are and what you represent. And Carrie and I, we've talked about this a lot over the years. When I think about my Christianity, it's remember not who you are, but whose you are and who you represent. We belong to God. And that thought should give us pause, that we belong to God. Whose we are, a lot of times we'll claim our lineage. I'm the son of, in my case, Robert the second, Jr., the son of Robert Sr., but we're the children of God. And that's what Peter wants us to do. He wants us to claim our identity and then represent that identity. When he gives us that title, that chosen race, that royal priesthood, that holy nation, or calling us a people for God's own possession, he's helping us find our identity. He says we don't have to go looking in jobs or houses or whatever, what have you. He says God's given you an identity already. And then he tells us what we need to do. He gives us our marching orders, if you will. He says that we need to proclaim the praises of the one who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So how do we do that? How do we proclaim God's praises? Remember, all throughout this verse, Paul has been reminding the readers, these Jewish readers, of these Old Testament verses. You'll notice a lot of the verses this morning are from the Old Testament, and that's because Peter was reminding them of what they had already learned. And he now goes to Isaiah. He goes to Isaiah 42. And he says, "Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the coastlands." It's not limited to the coastlands, or we wouldn't have to do it because we live in the middle of the continent. But, and then in the next chapter, he says, "The people I form for myself will declare my praise." That's what we're called to do, declare the praise of God. And how do we do that? We just go around saying God is great? That's true. And for some people that might be effective. But I think that it's a little more personal than that. Knowledge without application is useless. Some of y'all are going to laugh, but I think I know how brakes work, right? You press the pedal with your foot, and that makes the rotor with the brake pads, the caliper, I don't know what I'm talking about, obviously. The caliper with the brake pads clamp down onto the rotor, and that pressure, that friction, slows down the rotation of the wheels, and that slows down the movement of the car. I can know that or think that I know that, but if I can't put that into action when a deer or an antelope or, living in Alaska, a moose runs out in front of me, what's going to happen? I'm going to crash. We have to not just have a knowledge of who we are, but we have to put it into action. And proclaiming the praises, as Peter phrases it, that means that we tell our story. We tell the story of who we were before and who we are now that we belong to God. We sometimes hear it referred to as our testimony. And I know that the church doesn't always like to use that word. But consider the book of Acts. Bunch of great sermons in there, right? But what's the one thing that's recorded three different times? It's Paul's conversion. We have the actual account, and then he tells it two more times. Why do you think that is? It's because there's power in testimony. Paul could have stood before, I think it was Felix, and said any of the other sermons. He could have given the sermon on Mars Hill again. You've got this unknown God, but I'm going to declare to you the God that made everything. But no, he stands up there and he tells them his story. Because his identity, who he is only found in God. And I know that can be really hard. I know that can be really challenging. But I want to encourage you, and I want to challenge you to give your testimony. Because that's recognizing who we are, that we belong to God, that we're part of a chosen race, that we're part of a royal priesthood. I didn't even talk about royalty. The fact that God uses royal, we are heirs to who? Jesus, the Son of God, the King of heaven. We're royalty. And God says you're a royal priesthood. He says you're a holy nation. We talked about purification. And he says we're a people for God's own possession. God chose you. And when you stop and think about that, how can we not proclaim God's praises? How can we not tell people where we were and who we've become because of God? And it needs to overflow in our lives just the way our parenthood or our profession colors our interactions, whether we realize it or not. If someone's a coach, there's an expectation that they're going to coach something, right? If we say someone's a sheriff, we expect them to uphold the law. If we say someone's a teacher, there's an expectation that they're going to teach. But when God calls us his people, his holy nation, these people that have been sanctified and set apart, there's an expectation there too. that expectation is for us to share the good news. It's interesting. We don't think about how much our profession colors our interactions with people. But I'm going to tell on myself a little bit. When I'm talking to you, I have a terrible time looking at people's eyes. It's just not something I'm comfortable with. I'm looking at your airway because one of the things I do in my job is I put in breathing tubes. So I'm looking at how wide your mouth opens. I'm looking at how short or how long your thyromental distance is. I'm looking at how many chins you have, because all of that tells me how hard or how easy it's going to be to put in a breathing tube. The other thing I'm looking at the back of your hands for your veins to see how easy it's going to be to start an IV. And it's not that I do this intentionally or that I do this consciously. It's just something that's become so ingrained in me because of my training and my profession that it happens automatically. And sometimes I'll just be driving down the road and I see somebody in the other car and I'm like, I hope I never have to intubate her. And that's where we need to be in our identity in God. It needs to overflow into our lives to the point that we don't even realize we're doing it. When someone says something at work, how we respond flows out of our identity. When our children push us to our limits, our response should flow out of our identity. It's a challenge. I'll be the first to admit that I stumble, that I forget my identity. But the invitation is open to you this morning. If you're not identified with the body, if you're not part of these groups, these names that Peter's given us, that invitation is always open. It's God's invitation. It's not my invitation. It's not Doug's invitation. It's God's invitation. The invitation to join, to be one of God's chosen people, is there. If you need prayers, if you need anything, the elders are usually hanging out at the doors. I'll be up front for just a minute. Whatever your need is, please come forward while we stand and sing. Bryce?